Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Up, you pop craze youngsters, and welcome to part two of the 50th episode of Chart Music. You'll notice we're not making a big deal about the 50th, because, you know, most of us have already had a 50th and we know what a fucking anticlimax that is. So we're moving on. We've only just begun, pop craze youngsters. We've scratched the surface and nothing more on our journey through old episodes of Top of the Pops. All right then, pop craze youngsters, it's time to go way back to March of 1996. Always remember, we may coat down your favourite band or artist, but we never forget, they've been on Top of the Pops more than we have.
Live and exclusive, the Prince and the Khalifs on Top of the Pops tonight.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, March the 21st, 1996, and we are immediately assailed by the sight of Prince Nazim Hamid with the WBO World Featherweight Championship belt over his shoulder, surrounded by six surly youths in baggy urban wear. He tells us that he and they, the Khalifs, will be live and exclusive on Top of the Pops tonight. And we kick right into the strains of Red Hot Pop, which has been in effect now for 13 months and is already showing its age. Mm. We're now 2 years into the Rick Blacksell era of Top of the Pops, aren't we, chaps?
Yeah.
Blacksell, the sixth executive producer of the show, moved into television from Radio 1, where he worked as a senior producer, making him the first non-TV person to assume the role. Taxed with the job of dragging the show firmly into the 90s, he was given pretty much carte blanche when it came to programming bands and artists. And in last week's episode, he completely broke with tradition, as an interview with him in this week's Melody Maker points out. It goes like this. Biss, Glaswegian purveyors of bratty disco punk, have become the first new and unsigned act to appear on Top of the Pops in 32 years. And the show's producer, Rick Blacksell, told the Maker this week that this was just one example of his determination to represent up-and-coming music alongside well-established chart residents. He said, Top of the Pops obviously uses the Top 40 to an extent, and certainly in the past always used to use it, but under the guidelines and the way I produce the show, I can go elsewhere looking for things. It's really important to have your David Bowies and Tina Turners on as well, but if you have those sort of acts on every week, what's different about Top of the Pops? They are huge names and they are great for the programme, but it's got to have a talking point and it's got to show new music coming through. And I'm luckily in a position where they let me get on and do that. I just want to break in there. Isn't that our job to break new music as pop craze youngsters and record consumers? Didn't we do that anyway?
A little bit. And we've always, on Chart Music, found it a little bit kind of sleazy and gross and wrong and contrary to the spirit of Top of the Pops when they have something on there that's not even in the top 40.
Yeah. Right?
We recognise that it happens from time to time, particularly during stagnant sort of January charts where they just have to. But
yeah, in the last episode they did just that, and also, you know, in the 70s and even 80s to an extent, they would have, you know, Lulu and Cliff You know, BBC stalwarts at the time. You know, they always found a way on, didn't they? So,
but we never liked it. We didn't like it then as Pop Craze youngsters. We don't like it now as Chart Music podders. So it's not as if he's doing something completely new here. I think that's a bit false. And also, the band he's talking about there, Biss, this whole thing about them being unsigned. I mean, they had a record out, you know.
It
was on Chemical Underground. They're on an indie label. That's not the same. I mean, it's semantic splitting hairs, really. But, you know, what's unsigned? All right, they weren't signed to fucking Warner Brothers. But, you know, they had a record out. You could go in a shop and buy it. There were just some peasants that he'd found busking on the street and said, I will turn you into stars.
Yeah, I mean, it's much vaunted how Black Seal got these supposedly renegade acts on Top of the Pops. But it had always happened. But yeah, you started seeing people like Stereolab and Marquee Smith and things like that getting on Top of the Pops. But it was notable for me from the off that those sort of supposedly unsigned, they weren't unsigned acts, were always from a certain, they were always from the indie world, basically.
Mm.
The show got musical, and it's not a good thing for Top of the Pops, I don't think, for it to just think of itself as a music show, as just another adjunct to the rest of BBC's music shows.
Yeah.
So, yes, he gets interesting bands on, I guess, but conversely, the way he treats pop music, as opposed to indie guitar music and stuff, is it's all kind of boy bands and big stars, and American stars always get beamed in, which isn't the same, or the video gets shown. So I think he although he's much praised, Black Seal, for what he did to Top of the Pops, so I think he...
By the telly people.
Yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, when I think about what's going on in the mid-90s, is this the most exciting kind of non-chart material you could get in there? No. But I should be remembering, surely, mid-90s, I should be remembering amazing performances by Snoop Dogg or Missy or some of these people that I was into at the time.
Yeah.
I don't. Wow. Yes. I remember the supposed renegade acts where I was meant to be sat at home thinking, oh, yes, these are our bands.
Mm.
Not really being that at all.
No.
So don't get me wrong, there were good things Black Seal did because he had to, because what was going on before he became producer was in danger of killing the show.
Yeah.
It was good that he got the DJs back, you know, rather than that rotating kind of cast of kids presenters that seemed to be doing it before. It was good he got rid of the album charts. It was good he got rid of that breakers section. Mm. But then, you know, he gets the DJs back, but then he starts the celeb presenter thing, which seems to unmoor it from Radio 1 a bit, which isn't always a bad thing, as we saw in the past with Julian Cope. But, you know, I actually, although Black Seal's seen as the last good era by a lot of people, I see it's the start of the end to a certain extent. It starts losing its kind of universal reach. And to be honest with you, I think it's start of the kind of messy chaos that Top of the Pops would continue to do until its end. I think it got unsure of itself, actually. There's a really notable thing throughout this episode, and I'm sure everyone else noticed it as well. That thing of the cheering and whooping that you constantly hear that has nothing to do with the music. It's always a dead giveaway that a party is dying when it has to be artificially boosted like that. It's like the way modern performance cars play fake engine sounds through the car stereo.
Yes.
Because, you know, even though they've got electric engines and stuff. I see the start of the end here rather than some golden era. These weren't what the fuck moments. Oh my God, it's Biss on Top of the Pops. It was more kind of, it just seems smug.
Yeah, well, he went on to say, 2 years before I joined Top of the Pops, I was watching it and it was full of faceless dance bands. And I thought, that's the reason the show is going down the pan. There's no energy coming off that sort of music. There's no personalities involved and it's bland. I knew that people hadn't stopped making guitars because I was going out to gigs. But watching Top of the Pops, you'd have thought guitar music was dead. And I think there's nothing more exciting than seeing someone rip the fucking guts out of a guitar sometimes.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Jesus Christ.
No energy in dance music at all, is there? Getting no energy off that.
KLF.
For fuck's sake.
Alternate.
Yeah, no personalities in The Prodigy or The Shaman, is there?
No.
For fuck's sake.
This entirely mirrors the kind of worst impulses in the music press at the time.
Yeah.
Oh, we need these big bands with quote-unquote characters in them who can be gobby. Well, hold on a minute. Why not give some of those dance people a chance to be gobby? I bet they would have been. and hip hop, yes, you've got an endless diet of gobby bastards, but who never seem to get on the cover. You know, he might tart it up as, oh, yeah, guitars are still being made, guitar music. I'm not saying he's a racist. I'm not saying that. But there's an underlying kind of proper music, let's get the proper characters back, bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, you know, when I think about The Midnight, that's the thing about this. It's the thing about when you, Al, when you were breaking down that issue of Melody Maker, 5 pages of fucking Oasis.
6, if you count the gig review.
You know, and the thing is, the trouble is, for me, as a music fan, and this was the peak era of getting shit tons of music through the door as well. This was the slight changeover from getting tapes through the door to getting CDs through the door at this point. But, you know, there was so much good stuff out there. For me, the mid-90s was a golden era for music. Mm. And yet the magazine that I worked for was making it look like a wooden age for music. And you know, and it's a similar thing going on with Top of the Pops. You know, there's all these kind of great dance records in there. Well, let's see these people. And you know that dance acts will put on a freakishly good show if, you know, given the chance. Mm. Far more than a few stumbly blokes with big sideburns doing the conventional band shape. So that quote's really revealing.
It always does my head in when people go, oh, dance bands on Top of the Pops, they were never interesting. It's like, well, you know, Top of the Pops of the late 70s and the early 80s, they seem to cope quite well with dance music.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously there's no Legs and Co. nowadays.
Yeah,
but
I mean, there is something to it. We have looked at this before when, you know, it is true that Top of the Pops struggled to convey the excitement of dance music. But the fault of that is on Top of the Pops. Mm. It's not on the music.
Exactly.
And this is something, I mean, and it is also true that sales of smash hits took a tumble in the late 80s. Well, for two reasons. Partly because the pop stars that were coming through were your sort of stock aching Waterman puppets. But also because, in terms of dance music, acid house and all that, it tended not to be very personality focused. So there is something to that. And it is true that Top of the Pop struggled. But yeah, it's up to people like Black Seal to make it work, not just to say, oh, well, tell you what, we'll bring guitars in instead.
Yeah. I mean, I think the push behind all of this in that era was an attempt to make the show credible. And I don't think credible is something that Top of the Pop should be. Top of the Pops is what it is. It is a show that should be dominated by the previous week's charts and what happened in that.
Yes.
And you can understand how in the mid-90s, record companies were starting to look at Top of the Pops as not necessarily something they want to get their bands on that much or get their artists on because, you know, last week's charts are no longer important to record companies to a certain extent. And as the 90s go on, it becomes increased. You know, bands want to get on the national lottery more than they want to get on the charts. But I would say this focus on guitar music, it oddly does mirror exactly what's going on in the press. But all it needs is a journalist with fucking 2 brain cells stuck together to go out, interview these bands, not these bands, rather these dance artists, and get their stories. They're people, they're interesting, and they've probably got a damn sight more interesting stuff to say than fucking 2 twats from Burnage.
Mm.
Do you know, it's interesting, without wanting to spoil this episode too much, but we do get to the chart countdown, and whether Black Seal likes it or not, there is fuckloads of dance music in the charts,
and
there's hardly any guitar music.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what? It surprised me that the theme tune at this point even has a name. You said it's called Red Hot Pop?
Yes.
Because
by Vince Clark.
Vince Clark. It's the use of it is very short, isn't it?
Well, it's a sting, isn't it? It's not even a theme tune now.
So you've got lots of blue and orange things flying at you. You've got like a speaker cone and you've got someone with headphones on and someone holding up a shield. But it is like a little 5-second sting. It's almost as if Top of the Pops is embarrassed to have a sort of a theme and be, you know, be a sort of show like, da-da, we're here. It's almost apologetic.
Yeah, Top of the Pops almost seems like it's really there as a kind of like a trailer for Top of the Pops 2, which is far more credible. Top of the Pops is like the little baby's version.
I wanted to talk about the little clip we do get of Prince Nassim at the start there as well.
Yes.
Which is, for a start, he doesn't say live and exclusive. He says lav and exclusive.
Yes.
Because he's talking in MLE, Multicultural London English, even though he's not from London. But which I love, actually. I liked it hearing that on Top of the Pops. Something nice about it. So he goes, it's Prince and the Caliphs on Top of the Pops tonight. And yeah, you know, you mentioned he's got his world featherweight belt over his shoulder. I thought it makes him look like He's halfway through getting dressed up as Russell Crowe in Gladiator. And he does this amazing thing. He poses side on and he sort of he smoulders at the camera and he's holding a fucking gold microphone. Now, I thought that was his own touch. And it would be like, and that if it was his own touch, it would be a very Naz touch to have a gold.
Leopard skin be more his thing.
Yeah. But it turns out that the presenters, as we will find out, also have gold microphones.
This is the golden microphone era, isn't it? When they brought in the celebrities. But your host tonight, born in London in 1964, Steve Lamack studied journalism at Harlow College and went on to work as a junior sports reporter on the West Essex Gazette whilst editing the fanzine A Pack of Lies. He joined the NME in the 90s and was the first writer to interview Blur, Ride and Teenage Fan Club, but was best known for the interview with Manic Street Preachers where Richie Edwards carved For Real into his arm. By this time he had branched out into radio as a DJ on the pirate station Q102, which later became XFM, and he joined Radio 1 at the end of 1993 where he was teamed up with Joe Wiley, who was born in Northampton in 1965 and started her career presenting a local music show on BBC Radio Sussex before moving to Radio 4 to become a researcher on WPFM, their youth programme, with an F. When the co-presenters Gary Crowley and Terry Christian left, Wiley took over. After producing and presenting an indie show on BSB, she moved to Channel 4 to become a researcher for The Word before being picked up by Radio 1 and lumped together with Lamack for the evening session in Kid Jensen's old slot. At this point, they're still running the evening session together, although Wiley also has a side job on Saturday afternoons at Radio 1. They were given a trial run in presenting Top of the Pops in September last year, and this is their second go. Well, chaps, they're still chucking celebrities at Top of the Pops. This month has seen Louise Wenner and M&A have had a go, and they've also got Chris Eubank lined up for next month. But they appear to be at least trying to ease in more Radio 1 talent, and here we have, I suppose you could call them the Britpop, John Peel and Janice Long.
You could do. I mean, look, it's been, what, 30-odd years now. I think the de rigueur thing is that I should probably recant previous statements that I've made about everyone in the 90s.
No, never.
Well, I said at the end of a Kula Shaker review, I think, that the album made me want to go around Joe Wiley's house with suicide bombs strapped to my body, which she's got kids. It's not really fair. That fundamentalism has gone for me now. I would just crash a muck spreader into her conservatory. But for me... Both of them, Steve Lamack. I mean, look, Steve Lamack, I'm sure, is a nice guy. People who've met him more times will tell me that repeatedly. But for me, both of them sum up pretty much everything that was most appalling about the 90s and everything that's most appalling about radio now, in particular Wiley, because I think she's proved horribly influential on the sort of Edith Bowmans and Fern Cottons of this world.
Oh, yes.
Which might sound reductive, but what I'm on about is that kind of mindless positivity. Mm. Oddly mirroring of the way that the music press was going at the time was Joe Wiley's stock in trade.
Yeah.
If a musician started playing something, Joe Wiley would sit down next to them and earnestly nod with a Parker on, just lost in this musician's genius. And that's always pissed me off.
Yeah.
And Lamack, when I used to listen to the evening session with him, he had this habit of saying something was going to completely rock your world and change your life and was going to come roaring out your speakers and it would be like being fist-fucked by the Incredible Hulk or something. And then all that would come out was this weedy kind of pootling indie nonsense. Mm. So that kind of hyperbole is something that Zane Lowe's...
Kick in the sun!
Exactly. The kind of thing that Zane Lowe has made a career out of. The thing is with these two... I got no sense that even though they were DJs, there was no discernment, if you like. When I think of Nightingale and Peel and people like that, there was discernment. With Wiley, I never really got that. And by 96, by the time we find them in this episode, we're now into the second wave of shit Britpop. We're into the kind of, you know, the really unpleasant big sideburn Britpop years. And an era in which we are being told by people like Lamack and Wiley that and all kinds of earnest movers and shakers that, you know, Echo Belly and Republica and Cast and The Verve were more deserving of our attention than what we were listening to, which for me tended to be Eurobeat and pop music and hip-hop. So for me, it's an era in which the foundations and blueprints of that kind of crucial retreat of nerve committed on our behalf by a shit-scared media start happening. And I don't see anything different with Lamac and Wiley. I blame them for a lot. In a great era for pop and Eurobeat, they disdained it. In a good era for rap, they preferred trip-hop. In a great era for metal, rock music, they preferred the fucking Stereophonics. And I think... a big part of the reason that I felt frustrated at Melody Maker and just generally frustrated in the mid-90s was, yeah, that thing. There was so much good music going on. I would very rarely get to hear it through either of these fuckers.
Simon, Steve Lamac, NME.
Yeah, well, you know, cards on the table. I like Steve Lamac. I also want to say straight up front, I love the fact that Neil isn't recanting, that he's sticking to his guns. The only thing he sort of dialed back a little bit is his method of retribution. As a Melody Maker man, obviously I resented the phenomenon whereby NME writers were fast-tracked into jobs at the BBC. The effects of which are with me to this day. It's why, you know, I'm still fucking struggling to make a living and...
talking to us, cunts.
Yeah, talking to you, cunts. But I couldn't begrudge Steve personally. And we come from incredibly different places musically. He was once called the most indie man in Britain, along with Simon Williams, also of the NME. And he's waving the flag for indie here. He's wearing a top, I noticed, from Elemental Records, which is the little label that in 1996 was putting out records by Bivouac and Truman's Water, which is really not my world, really not my music. But he's always been good to me personally. I've got to put that sort of disclaimer on anything I say. He was very helpful when I was writing my Mannix book. He agreed to be interviewed about the Richie Edwards For Real incident. He gave me access to the actual interview tapes from that night in Norwich.
I've got to ask, Simon, were you jealous when you heard about that? Why didn't Richie do that in front of me?
No, because it was clear that Richie did it as a sort of statement of disgust, that he was being asked insultingly reductive questions. Because that was the whole point, that, you know, Steve had this... Steve was coming from this place of indie cred, and the Mannix were very flash, and the Mannix had signed to a major label. And from his perspective, from Steve Lamac's perspective, everything the Mannix were about was somehow... to be something to be suspicious of. They were somehow fake. And he put that to them. And fair play, he actually put it to them rather than stitching them up afterwards. And it turned out that it was them that needed stitching up.
He was outside having a fag, just white as a sheet at what he'd seen. Fucking horrible thing to have had to witness.
Absolutely, so even from that point of view, I don't envy it. Obviously, I wrote plenty of... sort of quite significant features about the Mannix myself. I can't really complain about that. Steve was fucking brilliant, really helpful when I was sort of doing a chapter on all that in my book. He's had me on his radio show a couple of times. And even though we rarely overlap musically, I do believe he genuinely loves music.
I agree.
I don't believe Joe Wiley genuinely loves music. I've always reacted very negatively to her, and hearing Neil describe it as mindless positivity hits the nail on the head for me. My reaction to her is almost visceral, I'll say that, because I think it was often that thing of not wearing shoes when she presented Glastonbury or when she presented her Channel 4 show, because I am the opposite of a foot fetishist. I'm the anti-Tarantino in that way. But I just never believed she ever knew much about music. And when you gave that, Gracie, of her broadcasting career there, it all fell into place because some of it was music-based, a lot of it wasn't. Essentially, she's a media person, a bit of a hack, really. She was, and she is on this episode, she is a presenter, just a presenter, rather than a DJ. And that made her, as Neil suggested, a very modern creature, because that is now the norm, you know. Obviously, there are precedents for this. Noel Edmonds didn't love music. Dave Lee Travis didn't love music. They were just presenters.
No.
And, you know, there will be some who will watch Steve Lamac here and they will think he's shaking John Peel. Fair enough. But I think he's sincere in loving the music he loves, which tended to be scrappy, scratchy indie music by white blokes with guitars. But Joe Wiley is no Janis Long.
No, no. You know, the music lover DJ is something that I love. That can be a great thing. But what it... Wiley portrayed herself as that, but what it really meant was just this suffocating sycophancy to musicians and the total abandonment of any kind of critical faculty. I completely agree, Simon. I think Steve Lamatt always struck me as definitely somebody who knew what he loved in music and definitely had opinions about it. With Wiley, I blame her perhaps for too much, but you know the whole sort of live lounge phenomenon of kind of, you know, this that has now indirectly led to so many fuckers thinking acoustic covers are suitable showcases for their talent. I blame Wiley for all of that. I blame Wiley for that kind of that sycophancy to musicians, to the point where anyone making music must be applauded. It's a good thing that they're making music. It's better than they're not making music. And that's how Wiley always came across. Just one caveat though to my, I wasn't particularly slagging off Lamac, but perhaps there's something personal in this, in as much as a while back a video appeared on YouTube of Steve Lamac reading an elegy for Britpop, and this was left as a poem, I think, on the Word magazine website, and somebody had asked him to read it out, and he read it out over, you know, MyTunes style music, and one of the lines was about singles reviews where Neil Kulkarni wrote about his girlfriend, and I watched that and I was like, you fucking bastards, that was Michael fucking Bonner, not me, as if I'd fucking write that. So maybe there's a little bit of grievance there, but I'm sure that's not Steve's fault.
That is bad though, yeah.
Wow.
But Wiley's, you can see them everywhere now. And throughout BBC's music coverage, they're everywhere. This is mindless positivity about music with no kind of discernment whatsoever. So I blame her for a lot.
Hi, and welcome to the beast that is Top of the Pops. I'm Joe Wiley.
And I'm Steve Lamack, and this is an anthemic start from Shed 7.
The Mac in a dark blue top with two gold stripes down the side, and Wiley in a see-through dress with blue flowers over a bra top, welcome us to the beast that is Top of the Pops and introduces to some anthemic stuff from the opening act, Shed 7 and Going for Gold. We've already covered Shed 7 in Chart Music 21, and this, their seventh single, is the follow-up to Getting Better, which got to number 14 in January of this year. It's the third cut from the LP A Maximum High, which isn't even out for another fortnight, and it's entered the charts this week at number 8, their highest chart placing ever, and here they are in the studio to rip the fucking guts out of a guitar. Well, yeah, Shed 7, we've already discussed them. I think we can wring some more juice out of them. But before that, let us nip a mere 2 years into the future and an interview with the NME conducted by Stephen Wells, which goes as follows. The sad fact is that the sinister, out of touch and utterly evil London rock press think that Rick Witter is a boring bastard from a rubbish band with a bollocks name. They think he is the soul-witheringly mediocre spiritual heir of Brian Adams. They think he's got shit hair. And they think he stinks of piss. This bloke was meant to be reviewing our single, and he said that he came up to York and saw me and was overcome by the smell of piss, snarls Rick. I do not smell of piss. Even if I did smell of piss, which I never do, I would immediately cleanse myself. Rick and Shed 7 drummer Alan Leach are sat in a London pub, sipping lager and killing time before the 5:30 train takes them back home to York. On your behalf, I sniff them gingerly. Neither of them, it has to be admitted, smells particularly of piss. I mean, it just wasn't needed, storms Rick. He could have just gone, this is the new Shed 7 single, it's shit. That would have been okay. Ah, but maybe your alleged pissy smell was a metaphor for the shitness of your record? Yeah, well, but he got it wrong anyway because I didn't stink of piss. Look, let's not get bogged down on this, pleads Rick. The point is that if you don't like a record, you should just say so. You shouldn't just say that the singer stinks of piss because there's a lot of kids out there right now who think that I smell of piss. The reviewer of that single, Neil Kulkarni of Melody Maker.
Well, I mean, look.
Neil, the truth.
The truth, right. Well,
did Rick Witter stink of piss?
Yes. Yes, he did. I'm going to stick to my guns.
Did he?
I'd like to clarify one thing. I did not go up to York to see Shed 7. No. I met Rick Witter, or I saw Rick Witter, as in his presence. Because I was studying in York in the early 90s. I went to uni there.
Right.
And I lived near the Roundtree's Chocolate Factory, which was a nice place to live. And I started going to clubs like Ziggy's and Toff's in York. My favourite North Yorkshire clubbing experience, by the way, was in a club in Scarborough called Bacchus, which had a dance floor the size of a dining table. A fantastic place. But I used to see Shed 7 doing that we're a local band, but we're a bit bigger than a local band now thing. Going around to the clubs in York. And I used to see him get him a lot of attention. That particular singles review mentioned the time when I was in a club, I think it was Ziggy's, and I went and stood near Rick Witter because I was wondering what all the fuss was about, why these people were thronging around him.
Yeah.
And yeah, he stank of piss. I'm going to stick to my guns there.
Right.
I mean, I know that I used the stinks of piss thing quite a lot at that time. I believe I said it about Jo Wiley as well, but I think I just said that she looks like she stinks of piss.
Right.
But... you know, the point is about saying that somebody stinks of piss, it's irrefutable legally. And the main thing is, just saying a record shit, that's not going to make a record review. You have to amplify and elaborate and use metaphors, etc. But he didn't metaphorically stink of piss. I recall him stinking of piss. And it wasn't, before any wag chips in, it wasn't my top lip. It was him.
Right.
So you're saying about Bacchus that you won't dance in a club like this, all the girls are slags, and the band smell just like piss.
Too bloody right. They did. Shed 7, fucking hell. I mean, it's a frequent motif for me throughout chart music that, you know, those pop stars who look like they stink. Well, he's one of them, and he did. Because I had prior experience. But yeah, I didn't go up to York to see Shed 7.
No.
He just happened to swim into the nightclub that I was in. And I was glad...
Waft into the club.
And I was glad to verify that. And I was glad to use that later in that particular...
So if he... If he offered to make you a sandwich...
No, fuck no. Fuck no. It'd have yellow stains on it, man. No. No. But the thing is... You know, I'd like to say, with Shed 7, I could attack it in that way. But in a way, looking back, this sort of music, you know, it won, in a way. It won whatever battle was going on. Walk into a pub or a club in, 2021 or whatever, and you'll still be able to see bands doing shit like this. And Going for Gold, as a title, revealed a lot. This was ultimately music that wanted to lodge itself in student memories like the final round in fucking Blockbusters. But I mean, it is a revealing performance. You know, the live singing thing had come in a few years previous in Top of the Pops.
Yes.
A horrible mistake.
No, dear, it is an unseemly thing to countenance in the shape of Shed 7, isn't it?
It's a horrible mistake to make him sing live. It reveals all his limitations. So in that section where it kind of builds, there's a bit of a key change and he has to go for it. It's so singularly lacking in confidence and oomph, really. But shit like this, I mean, the thing is about Shed 7 and bands like that, and there were so bloody many of them, that they, for me at the time, sort of reasserted how valuable the good stuff was. Because there were dozens of bands like the bands like this, but there was only one Pulp, or there was only one Super Furry Animals. Whereas, look at Shed 7 in this performance, and that slightly piss-takey gold suit he's wearing is a dead giveaway.
It looks like they've got a tramp off the street at very short notice to fill in for someone who was going to be Martin Fry on Stars in the Rise.
Well, Martin Fry had the height, you see, whereas Rick Witter doesn't. The legs on this suit are way too long. Rick Witter's a short ass, so they all look wrinkled up. You should have checked on these things.
And you just think those trousers, are they gold or is it
But the thing is...
See, this is a wise move. They're gold trousers. Yeah, yeah. See, he's not wearing grey trousers, which is the cardinal error made by someone prone to pissing themselves.
Yeah, yeah. No, sensible thinking. Yeah. Oh, that bit of copy you read out, though, really makes me miss Stephen Wells a lot. But all of these sounds that you're hearing from Shed 7, these were getting absorbed by tiny minds, and they would wreak damage for years to come. We're still living with the damage that bands like Shed 7 wrought, in a way. Yeah.
Simon, in you come.
Well, I've been in the presence of Rick Witter twice, and on neither of those occasions, as far as I recall, did he stink of piss. But that doesn't mean... See, that doesn't prove that he didn't stink of piss when Neil was near him.
Yeah.
The first time I remember being near him, I was walking around Portobello Market in West London, and I was looking through a clothes store, and I realised there was a guy stood near me trying on a pair of trousers. So he'd actually taken his own trousers off.
No!
He'd taken his own trousers off, so he's down to his kecks, and he's trying on.
Was he wearing a tenner?
Well, he was, exactly. He was wearing a kind of see-through adult nappy that was like swimming in piss. No, he was...
Him and Roachford. They could make a fucking killing doing adverts for that shit now, couldn't they?
And Fergie, man.
I'm Fergie, yeah.
So, he was trying on this pair of multicoloured stripy trousers that looked like a jester. And I really judged him on that. I thought, if he didn't literally stink a piss, then his taste in clothing did. And then decades later, in fact, about 4 or 5 years ago, I actually interviewed him. It was backstage at a festival in Yorkshire where Shed 7 were the headline act.
Right.
And I was doing a bit of work. There was a festival TV station, and whoever lumbered interview backstage, I just had to grab him for an interview, and there he was. Perfectly nice bloke, as they always are. Yeah, they always are nice blokes, or nearly always, Neil's completely right about the effect they had musically, and we're still living with to this day. I don't know which writer it was. It might have been Andrew Harrison who coined the phrase landfill indie. Yes. But I think Shed 7 are very likely the year zero of landfill indie. They are the patient zero. That,
the first tin thrown onto the ground of landfill.
The first tin, is Shed 7. Steve Lamacq says an anthemic start from Shed 7. And he does a little smile, does Lamacq? Mm. Because this is his music, and it's actually his doing.
But
he championed them early on.
How shit would your country be if that's your fucking anthem?
Well, now here's the thing. Right, you correctly point out the suit. A gold suit used to mean ABC. Yes. Used to mean absolute dazzling
class.
And
before that, Elvis.
Hmm. Yeah. And they've got a horn section. A horn section on Top of the Pops used to mean Dexys.
Yes.
Right? And this shows how far we have fallen, that it now means this. And I kept listening to this song, and I don't really remember it from the time. And I start thinking, when does the anthemic bit happen?
Yeah.
When? Like, oh, I thought, okay, some songs can have an anthemic chorus, but the verse that gets you there is a bit nothingy. But it just never happened.
Yeah.
And the weird thing about... First of all, it's two weird things. First of all, this was a top 10 hit, which I don't know if that's just a quirk of the fact that Britpop was so huge that a moderately... a well-liked indie band could get in the top 10 just like that. But the lyrics, for fuck's sake, it goes, you took the words right out of my mouth, which is taken straight out of Meatloaf's mouth.
Mm.
They play their guitars in that really shitty indie way where their hands hardly even touch the strings.
Yeah.
They're just sort of drifting their hands up and down. The blokes, because the rest of the band are standard indie blokes in black.
They
look like they're just kind of vaguely thrilled to be there. They've got no charisma to them at all.
No.
And even Rick Witter, or as the press cruelly called him at the time, and I may have been part of that cruelty, Rick Fuck Witter. You can dress him up in a gold suit. You can hand him a pair of maracas to shake, which he does here.
It's a polished turd, isn't it?
He's got no dynamism. The song has no dynamism.
Yeah.
It's the most half-arse maraca shaking I've ever seen, man. And I've seen Ian Brown.
And Lamacq makes a little joke about that as he outros it. He says, shaking the Earth's core tonight on Top of the Pops. Fuck me. If the Earth's core was shaken like that, we wouldn't be here now, because there was just acres and gallons of that shit knocking around at the time.
Yeah,
it's really, really very poor. The weird thing about Shed 7 is They are bigger now than they ever were at the time. They were moderately big at the time. They become this thing that because they keep plugging away, and they play all those kind of those festivals called things like, oh god, what are they called? They
probably Live Forever or
they play like all these kind of like Cool Britannia festivals or whatever they are, including the one that I interviewed.
The Tremolos of their age.
Yeah, exactly. They just kept on going.
Yeah,
and so they can now fill Brixton Academy at the drop of a hat, or probably three nights running. They can headline festivals, and it's a weird sort of anomaly in the industry. It's a weird little tale in itself, as long as you don't have to listen to their music. Yeah. And like I say, seems like a perfectly nice bloke, but fucking hell, you know, what he did and what his band did led on to things like Scouting for Girls and all of that shit that clogged up the noughties and clogged up the 2010s and is still with us to this day.
Yeah.
So it can do one as far as I'm concerned.
The reason bands like that still go in, they do keep plugging away. I mean, what's being sold essentially is nostalgia. I doubt anyone's sitting around listening to Shed Sevens albums and recovering what musical geniuses they were. But people want to feel if they're in their mid-40s, they want to feel like they did when they were young. So they'll buy tickets for shit like that. But that Lamac phrase at the end really got to me, that "and then shaking the earth's core." That kind of jokey NME type hyperbole really used to piss me off. And still does. And the odd thing is, with this record, Going for Gold, it is their best. This is as good as Shed Seven get.
So the following week, Going for Gold dropped 12 places to number 20. The follow-up, Bully Boy, would only get to number 22, but they'd have two more top 20 hits this year, making them the most prolific chart band of 1996.
What?
Yes. Jesus.
Fucking hell.
They had more hits this year than any other band.
Jesus.
Fucking hell.
Hello, I'm Jack Beaumont. I do Crime Club. In Series 1, I spoke to people like this.
Did you not kick a policeman in the head?
Yeah, that was... When was that? I was 17. Wait, was I 17 or 19? I think it might have been 19, actually.
In Series 2, I talked to people like this.
There was a paedophile with one leg. I kicked him clean out his wheelchair. About four of us... I mean, we battered him.
And this.
Cheating on your boyfriend to give him gonorrhea? Do you want to go there, or would you rather not?
Yeah, no, I could talk about it.
I have jingles like this. That's Crime Club, where strange people tell stories involving bad behaviour. New episodes out every Monday.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Shaking the Earth's Core tonight on Top of the Pops, we have two exclusives from Lionel Richie and world featherweight boxing champion Prince the Scene. Plus, we have garbage and menswear.
But first, cracking America, yes, really, mingling with the rich and famous, and how our friends in the North, Oasis.
Lamac continues to shill the bill of fare for tonight, while Wiley tells us that the next act are playing in America and mixing with the rich and famous. which is something bands have never done before, and then gets in a plug for a recent BBC drama as she introduces Don't Look Back in Anger by Oasis. Formed in Manchester in 1991, Oasis are fucking Oasis. This is their ninth single, the fourth cut off the LP What's the Story Morning Glory, and the follow-up to Wonderwall, which got to number two for 1 week in November of 1995, held off the top spot by I Believe by Robson and Jerome. It made its first appearance on Top of the Pops on February the 22nd, 3 days after it was released, where they followed it up with a performance of Come On Feel the Noise, making them the first band to play two songs on an episode of Top of the Pops since The Jam in 1982. A week later, it entered the chart at number one, usurping Spaceman by Babylon Zoo, but was immediately knocked off the top by this week's number one. This week, it's spending its second week at number three. And because the band are in Dublin, where the News of the World are currently stalking their hotel with Noel and Liam Gallagher's father in the hopes of a reunion, after they set up a phone line where you could listen to a phone conversation between Liam and his dad, with the former threatening to break the latter's legs, we're getting a repeat of a month-old performance. Why? Why is this even happening? This is last month's number one.
Because they're Oasis, man.
I mean, Neil, you know, we've come across this phenomenon before when they had Craig David back on again in 2000. But this is a song that's been at number three for its second week. What the fuck is going on here?
It's a music lovers show now. Didn't you hear the memo?
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like BBC News now going, oh, you know what? Fucking coronavirus again. Sick of that. Let's talk about that royal wedding that everyone liked. It's not right, man. Top of the Pops is dead to me now.
This fucking song is probably one of my... I mean, it probably is my least favourite song ever. And talking about things to recant from the past, as I have about Joe Wiley slightly. I know with most bands, even the ones that you hate, there's this rule whereby you will love one of their songs. With Oasis, that is not the case for me. As soon as I hear even a second of their music, I want to vomit. And I wish these enemies of beauty nothing but misery for the rest of their days. And that extends to all their fans. Hate this band. I mean, I don't know whether Pricey needs to come in before I just go off on one.
No, please take the floor, Neil. Go for it.
Well, I mean, for me, you know, it's odd. In recent years, we've seen an awful lot of bullshit written about how, you know, the 90s were all about Oasis and Nirvana, and it was about attitude coming back. For me, my memories of this era and thinking about this era now is that, you know, Definitely Maybe and things like that and Oasis... It meant the cunts taking over. It meant the proper homophobic, mildly racist lads taking over. It meant the rejection of puffiness stylistically and the reassertion of the kind of English Rock Defence League's tiny-minded ideas about real proper music. So it just sees rock regressing into this pure, soulless pastiche. It also means, in this period, a cowardly, craven press surrendering any critical standpoint in fear of this supposed consensus. National broadcasters and publishers boosting the lads, the coked up and the Larry. And deeper than that, it meant a reassertion of quite racist and sexist music stereotypes and snobbery. Beyond that, sorry, it enabled also a middle class media to a certain extent to homogenise its ideas about what counted as working class art.
Yes, Neil.
Yeah. Ever since the 90s, when I've slagged off Oasis or The Roses or any of those bands, I've had it back, oh, you must hate the working classes, as if this is all the working classes can do,
exactly,
this kind of thing. I mean, I would use Oasis. If I was teaching a lesson about the 90s, I would use them, but not in a kind of this is how good things got kind of way, but this is definitively 90s. It celebrates the mediocre so long as it's arrogant. And it's this cultural environment.
And as long as it's successful.
Yeah, and as long... Oh, it has to be successful, of course. It has to have hundreds of thousands of zeros attached to all the figures attached to it. It creates this cultural environment in which anyone can be... I think this is the start of the word, the start of the overuse of the word iconic and legendary right about this period. Because anyone can be iconic and legendary, seemingly in the 90s, so long as you just tediously and endlessly assert the fact. So long as you just keep saying that you're, you know, a rock and roll band. So, yeah, I'm not going to celebrate this fucking hoax, this con job, this cowardice, and this essentially a triumph for reactionary conservatism. And beyond anything else, the shitty music, the fucking utterly shit music. I'm not going to celebrate this in any way. I've always fucking hated Liam Gallagher, perhaps more than any other British pop figure in the past two decades. There was something I read, I mean, beyond all the homophobic shit that he's come out with over the years, which is unforgivable and disgraceful. I remember reading him about Adam Ant, and it was a comment that really summated a lot of things. He said, Adam and the Ants, no, I'm not into a geezer who wears makeup, especially fucking nutty ones. Yep. Yep, that's absolutely it. You know, doubtless he thinks British pop history would have been better entirely populated by these sort of gurning faux simpleton fake lads wearing smart casual dad's clothes. But he's just a fucking charmless, thick as shit cunt, and I wish he'd fuck off and die. I've never seen either of those brothers as kind of, you know, the witty characters that they're frequently seen as. But yeah, they are definitive of the 90s, because if you just say that you're rock and roll often and drearily enough, it makes you iconic. And if you're half-wit, it's this kind of, you know, there's frequently moments where I listen to Oasis records and I just think, is honestly, are you that larceny, that theft, that laziness, you really think that'll do? And they do think that'll do. And clearly an awful lot...
And it did.
Yeah, and it did. An awful lot of music fans thought it'd do as well. And if that's admitted, then any kind of pastiche is okay. And, you know, it's this admission of a kind of general a bit shitness that you can't be as good as the past, but you can sort of innocently thieve it a little bit. This kind of attitude that's scruffed up like factory damaged jeans. So for me, Oasis, they're the Chris Evans of music. And if you like them, you must despise pop music. They're the single artist, the single band, rather, that most sums up all I most detest in rock and pop music over its entire history. I know it's common to say now, oh yeah, but those early singles, come on, they were undeniable. Nope. Sorry, they have always, for me, made the most revoltingly lumpen, conservative sound in music. Yes, they absolutely are iconic and legendary. And if you like them, you and their fucking rubbish music and those kinds of adjectives deserve each other, you cunt. They're an appalling band. And you know, especially in recent years, one thing I've noticed creeping into Noel Gallagher's quotes, now that he's moneyed up and he's sending his kids to posh schools, there's a definite tinge of kind of racism and Brexitiness in what he's been saying about his schooling, about the schools that he's sending his kids to, how he'd rather his kids hung around with Russian oligarchs all day than came home sounding like Ali G, and how he doesn't want to send them to school where there's metal detectors on the doors, and how he fucking loathes hip-hop and he doesn't think Jay-Z should headline Glastonbury. All of these things. And he doesn't like reading and he doesn't like jazz. And he's just, Oasis, for me, have always just been a celebration of stupidity. And conservatism, and
The sound of a door slamming shut.
Well, for me, they are they're kind of, it's weird because they're one of the biggest bands of the 90s. For me, they're the nadir of the 90s. So, watching various videos of England fans over the years adding to their repertoire of "Fuck the IRA" and 10 German bombers with Oasis songs is very revealing to me. Much as it was the other day when I saw some cunt in a fucking multicoloured harlequin style suit leading a street-long sing-along at the 8 o'clock clap for the NHS of Don't Look Back in Anger revealed a lot to me as well. It is that kind of national anthem, and I fucking hated it then, and I hate it now.
I mean, Simon, how much to the fault can be lumped on the music press for Oasis?
A fair amount can be lumped.
They were hyped up to fuck at the beginning. I remember when their first album came out, they got a cover on Q, and the tagline was to the effect of, "Here they are, the band you've all been waiting for." And it's like, really? Them?
I think Neil made a really important point about the homogenisation of the way the working class were seen and depicted in the media around this time. And it was entirely down to Oasis. In fact, I remember a thing Neil wrote, because Noel had said something like, "I'm writing songs for the guy who's going to the local newsagents to buy his 10 Benson Hedges." And Neil wrote, "Fuck off, I'm that guy, you're not writing songs for me." And, you know, this is the awkward truth about Oasis and about their media cheerleaders, is that it suited the predominantly white male very middle class, very southern music press to imagine that Oasis represent the true proletariat, or the lumpen proletariat, if you like, of the UK, and that anyone who diverges from that stereotype just isn't properly working class. And that even goes back to that Melody Maker front cover that you mentioned earlier on, where what's the headline, what's the thing on the front again? It's like, "Are you looking at me, pal?" Is that it? It's this imagined idea. That's not a quote, you know. It's just because you've got a picture of Noel looking a bit sort of chippy, and we're meant to think, oh yeah, you know, he's this tough street fighting northerner. Fuck off. Apart from anything else, Oasis are really soft. I will defend that to the death, that they are fucking soft. They're just pretending to be hard. Like, the one time that Liam started acting hard in Germany in front of a bunch of fucking management consultants out on a jolly or something, he got the shit kicked out of him, didn't he? Do you remember that? But yeah,
happened in Milan as well.
I despise this idea that the working classes of Britain are not allowed to A, have, consume, and B, create things of beauty. And we're not allowed to be poncy or arty or well-read. And I'm saying that I grew up in a terraced house in South Wales with fuck all money, single parent. We didn't have a car. We didn't have a telephone. A lot of the time we didn't have a TV because it kept having to be sent back because we couldn't afford it and all this kind of shit. You guys, you're from the Midlands. You're right, you're not from the North, but you're not part of that London or that Southern bubble. So you know as well as I know, how fucking mendacious that is, that idea that everyone in the North, or everyone from sort of a working class area, is like those cunts, right? And it's really important, in order to disprove that, to be able to point to counterpoints, to examples who do diverge from that. And conveniently enough, and we've already mentioned them in this episode, Manic Street Preachers, right? The Manic Street Preachers are as, if not more, working class than Oasis. But they educate themselves. They were proud of their learning. They put quotes from literature and philosophy all over their record sleeves. They started their biggest hit at the point that it came out with the line, "Libraries gave us power." And you get these dicks, the Gallaghers, boasting about not reading books. And
could I just chip in there? Sorry, Pricey. Yeah, the direct quote from Noel: "Booksellers, book readers, book writers, book owners, fuck all of them."
Exactly. And, you know, the media lapped that up. Because there's nothing the southern middle-class media love more than a bit of rough. The illicit thrill they get from a bit of rough. Yeah. And that's what Oasis represented. By the way, you can go on Google Earth and look at the fucking suburb that they came from. Yeah, I'm sure it had its social problems. And I'm sure they didn't have much money. They've got a lovely big leafy street with big front gardens, big back gardens. Do me a fucking favour. You know, just because they talk, it's like Jess Phillips. Everyone thinks that just because she talks in a regional accent, she's got to be properly salt of the earth working class. Her fucking mother ran the NHS in the Midlands. You know, that's an 80 grand a year job.
I mean, the music press, they lumped on the Stone Roses and Happy Mondays a few years previous.
So that was the beginning of this,
Both of those bands fucked up. Here's a band who are not going to fuck up. And, you know, you just had Oasis rammed up your arse right from the off.
Yeah, and there was a trade-off, right? A lot of people who should have known better, who did know better, people of my age and slightly older, decided, you know what, we may have grown up listening to, I don't know, The Fall or Echo and the Bunnymen or, you know, any of these kind of vaguely cerebral indie bands. But we're going to sort of brush all that away and pretend that we're never into that stuff. And what we really want is something that sounds like the most reductive idea of what the Beatles were. Because it seems to be popular. It seems to be what the kids like. So I saw people of my age suddenly sort of wearing, you know,
the best minds of my generation,
the best minds of my, the best torsos of my generation, wearing vintage Adidas and all that kind of stuff. And just pretending to be something they weren't, because it was like, if you can't beat them, join them. And it seemed to be popular. And the amount of times in my work, I had to go and review Oasis gigs, and they quite often happen at Wembley. And you get out of Wembley Park Station and you'd walk up Bobby Moore Way, and there'd be all these fucking dicks doing the sort of crap themselves, bandy-legged walk up towards the stadium or the arena, and they'd be wearing those fucking wicket-keeper hats or fisherman's hats, whatever you want to call it, and they, too, are pretending to be this idea, you know, because they've all come from fucking, I don't know, Roehampton or something, but they are pretending to be lads.
Yeah, yeah.
And because that is now, A, all the working class are allowed to be, and B, what we're supposed to aspire to, it's the very limit of what we can aspire to. That is why, for me, Oasis are the, and I'm not exaggerating, the most malignant and damaging force in British popular culture of the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I agree completely. As I said at the time, I think Oasis give you rickets. But it's interesting that you mention Happy Mondays. Happy Mondays, yes, genuinely properly working class band. But look how weird their fucking music was. How liquid and funky and strange and complex it was. And also think about Sean Ryder's lyrics. I mean, these were amazing, amazing lyrics. The lyrics to Oasis records, I mean, this is a perfect example, this one. Look, for starters, you can get no meaning from them, so don't bother looking for any meaning. But they're just pitched at that kind of mix of phrases that clearly Noel Gallagher has overheard that he thinks are clever, like "Don't Look Back in Anger" from the play, from the John Osborne play, mixed in with just a load of shit about sliding away. It always seemed to be about sliding away from him and staying in bed. And they're just remorselessly unpoetic, unimaginative shit lyrics, coupled with this lumpen, awful music.
It's REO Speedwagon without a decent guitar solo, isn't it?
It's, I mean, I don't want to say roadie rock. I like some roadies, but I mean, it's lumpy, joyless, just and totally sexless music. It's just revolting.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know?
No, you're absolutely right to talk about the lyrics. Slip inside the eye of your mind. It's got to be one of those embarrassing opening lines. Yeah. It's embarrassing. And just this sort of lazy jamming together. So Don't Look Back in Anger, you've got Don't Look Back, the Bob Dylan documentary, and Look Back in Anger, the play, of course. Then you've got, like, they're quoting, you start a revolution in your head. So that's like a Beatles book, isn't it? Yeah. So they're fucking laying it on so
thick. Start a revolution from my bed, he says, doesn't
he? That's right.
Sorry. Oh, so
but it is, clearly, because Revolution in the Head had just come out, hadn't it?
Yeah. So there's all of that going on, and a lot of people say, "Oh, who cares? It's just pop music. Who cares about the lyrics?" Well, all right, fine. And to a point, I can go along with that. And I suppose in some ways, demonstrably, what they do works because they write these melodies that have those kind of descending triplets, like na 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 na, which is a thing that everyone's like, fucking Bowie did it. Bowie did it loads, circa Ziggy Stardust. George Harrison was a big one for that, and it's just a fairly easy way of giving a phrase in music a little bit of an emotional tug at the end. So they had that going on. I remember Taylor writing a review of them live where he talked about this kind of just this hurricane force that you feel at their gigs. Whether you like them or not, you just got sort of swept away and steamrolled by this kind of back and forth between the band and the audience. And I can kind of see that. But what does it give us? Where does it get you? There's fucking nothing to it at all. And the first thing you see in this clip, by the way, is the drummer's arse. And I think that is so telling because it is just a load of arse. You've got, even visually the signifiers, you've got Noel with his little Lennon shades on. You've got Liam sitting at the piano, prodding at a fucking piano with single fingers like he's doing chopsticks, but at a grand piano. He's also wearing the little Lennon glasses. It's so fucking desperate. You've got Bonehead there, by the way, which is the second sighting tonight of someone wearing an outdoor coat indoors. Britpop was the movement that wouldn't feel the benefit when it stepped outside. And then you've got Noel with his big fucking Brexit guitar. The big old
Brexit guitar.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you see it's a really bad paint job. I mean, the St. Patrick's cross has been put slap bang in the middle of the St. Andrew's cross, probably because whoever did it wasn't sure what the right way up the jack was and just isn't taking any chances. But you look at it and you go, oh, actually, that's really shit.
But this
symbolism, it was really shit anyway. It was just like, oh, look, let's pretend to be the Who.
Well, that's it. The symbolism of the Union Jack in popular culture is an interesting thing that's kind of shifted over time. In the 60s with the Kinks and the Who, it seemed to have this kind of slightly almost subversive optimism to it. It wasn't at that point poisoned by feelings of kind of racial white supremacy or any of that. Mm. That feeling crept in more in the 70s. But then you had the Jam trying to reclaim that whole sort of 60s thing again. Yeah. But then when Morrissey waves it around at Finsbury Park. And of course, what we know now about Morrissey, people were quite right to be very, very dubious about what his motivations were. Mm. Nevertheless, on the face of it, the only evidence that NME were really willing to present was that he was waving around the Union Jack. And what, 2-3 years later, you got these cunts with a massive fucking Union Jack on their guitar. And no one bats an eyelid. You got Jerry Halliwell in her Union Jack dress at the Brits. And suddenly it's all, yay, cool Britannia! And nothing sinister about it at all. And it turns out that, Gallagher's pretty Brexity, Jerry Halliwell's pretty Brexity. Yeah. Neil is absolutely right to call out their racism. We can all point at the famous remarks Noel made about having Jay-Z Stormzy headlining Glastonbury. They are massive, massive homophobes. I'm not going to let them off the hook about that. I was present at the Q Awards when Liam started shouting queer, queer to Robbie Williams when he went on stage, and lesbian, lesbian to Kylie Minogue. And by the way, the fact that neither of those are queer or lesbian is really not the point. That was his go-to insult for people that he didn't like, was queer and lesbian. There's plenty more examples, plenty more proof of their homophobia. Matter of fact, I was commissioned by a major, major national newspaper about a year ago to write an article about this stuff, about Oasis and their homophobia. Strangely, they got cold feet and bottled out and spiked that article. Now, I'm not ruling out that piece appearing online at some point soon, so that's something to look forward to. But yeah, they just didn't like anything remotely puffy. They were very dodgy when it came to black music and black people, as we've now found out. And he, Noel in particular, is a pull-the-ladder-up cunt. He's one of those ones. Because, for all their much-vaunted working-class background, he thinks that, and never mind Jeremy Corbyn, who he called a communist, he thought Ed Miliband was, in his words, a fucking communist. Ed Miliband! Because, heaven forbid anybody should want to redistribute any wealth.
He's the Jimmy Tarbuck of Manchester, isn't he?
Totally. In summary, fuck them. They're the worst thing to happen in 30 years. And I'm not going to say anyone who likes them is a cunt, because I know some lovely, lovely people who are Oasis fans, but they are misguided.
I've aired my feelings about Blur many a time and oft on Chart Music, but I remember when I moved back to Nottingham about 15 years ago, I'd go out or have to go out to see local bands. And 80% of them were Oasis clones.
Yeah.
They'd have the kind of publicity shot where it looked like they were standing outside of Wetherspoons on a Tuesday morning. And I just thought, fucking hell, if only there were a few more bands wanted to be Blur instead of Oasis, perhaps perhaps things would have been better back then.
I mean, we just said that Shed 7 unbelievably exerted an influence. Just think about the damage that this fucking band did. Oasis. And the thing is, I must admit, at the time, I was casting around trying, in 1996, I was basically trying to call everyone a racist. But, the Union Jack guitar didn't help. But you can't really go from that to racism. But I've been proved right over the years about this stuff. I mean, a lot of us have been proved right. Not only quotes from Noel. But yeah, it's odd when you look back, because now when I look back, it's like Pricey mentioned Morrissey. Now when I listen back to, say, Panic, I hear a race hate anthem. And in this music, fatally, Oasis won Englishness back for the non-fay and the non-puffy and the charmless, fundamentally. And we've been seeing it on stages nationwide ever since.
Yeah. And it's not like there weren't any other options. All right, the Manics were in hiatus at this point, but Jarvis Cocker was around.
Yeah.
He's a fucking working-class northerner, and he's fucking clever and, you know, funny and a bit puffy. And, you know, it, so, you know, sorry, journalists, is he not proly enough for you? Is he not enough of a fucking stereotype? Because he's not swaggering towards you, like, doing that kind of come on things with his hands, offering you out for a fight. Is that not real enough for you?
Piss and when off. He swears, you can't write it as F-double-O-K.
Yeah,
all of that. Talking about their influence, there was a thing just the other week on the Bank Holiday Monday where Radio X did their annual Best of British, where they asked their listeners to vote for this kind of countdown of the 100 best British songs ever. And 4 out of the top 10 were by Oasis. 17 out of the top 100 were by Oasis. And a massive chunk of the rest of it was, it might as well have been Oasis. And I do wonder, though, actually looking at the rest of that list, if Shed 7 haven't also exerted a massive influence on that. And bands like the fucking Cortinas and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's, and I know in some ways it's not exactly news. It's Dog Bites Man, that people who listen to a lad's guitar radio station like lad's guitar music. But nevertheless, it was the most depressing thing I've ever read. It was like, basically, if you wanted to find out what the worst British music ever is, look at what Radio X listeners think the best British music ever is.
And talking about Oasis being in lots of lists, I mean, this week in the charts, all 9 Oasis singles are in the top 100 this week.
Fuck me.
They've re-released them all, like when the Jam split up and when Michael Jackson died.
But it needs noting, right? The trouble is with looking back, especially from this vantage point, is the 90s are getting, have been rewritten.
In anger.
Well, fucking in a lot of fucking anger, to be honest with you. But I mean, you know, the 90s have now been rewritten as Oasis's decade. It just needs lodging somewhere, that there are an awful lot of us who fucking hated them from the off.
Yes.
You know, and we were there. We might not have ended up dominating the cultural landscape for the past 20 odd fucking years, but there were dissidents to this. The 90s were not just this. There was so much great shit going on. Oasis, one of the worst bands of this period.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, people did want it to be the 60s again. So therefore, they had to be a Beatles. And the general consensus in the media was, oh, they'll do. Let's lump on them.
Well, I do think Britpop was the first musical movement in this country that was entirely looking backwards. You're absolutely right that it needed a Beatles, and people were just gagging for that to happen.
Yeah.
And it became self-fulfilling.
I was instantaneously suspicious of Britpop for precisely that reason. Because when something looks back like that, and it only looks back like that, you have to wonder what dreams are being reanimated here. What are they clicking their heels together and wanting to vanish back to? And fundamentally, what they're wanting to vanish back to is time, in an odd way, where white British music was made by bands completely influenced by black American music. And yet the music that they vanished themselves back to absolutely wasn't that. You know, the 60s can mean a lot of things for a lot of people, but I think they got that era completely wrong in a sense.
Of course, we've got to mention the obvious nick of Imagine at the beginning, which was, you know, clearly you think we're ripping off the Beatles, well, fuck you.
Yeah,
but it also serves to mask the even more blatant nick, which is, so Sally can wait, pretty flamingo.
Yeah, man. But the thing is, that kind of brazenness became part of their shtick.
Yeah.
It's the same thing Robbie Williams would exploit later on in the 90s, and hence them becoming friends, I'm guessing. That we're getting away with it. Mm. Yeah, we're getting away with it. That kind of brazenness, that cheek, that arrogance. You know, arrogance is unjustified confidence. They had Noel Gallagher's musical abilities gave him no right to call himself a rock star. But by that time, it was enough for the idiots, their boosters in the press anyway.
Yeah.
That if somebody was just cocky enough, that was enough. I'm not sure.
Anything else to say?
No, fuck them. Fuck them forever.
Fuck them to hell.
So the following week, Don't Look Back in Anger dropped 5 places to number 8. The follow-up, Do You Know What I Mean?, went straight to number 1 in July of 1997, knocking I'll Be Missing You by Puff Daddy off the top, and staying there for 1 week before giving way to I'll Be Missing You again. It would go on to sell over 970,000 copies in the UK, and was the 11th best-selling single of 1996. One place above How Deep Is Your Love by Take That, and one behind To Become One by the Spice Girls.
I thought we were quite concise there.
Yeah. My soul. Oh, man, enough of this lumpy shit. I can't go on any further. I need a break. We're going to leave it right there, Podcraze youngsters. Do come and join us in the next part to see if this episode gets any better. Spoiler alert, no, it doesn't. On behalf of Neil Kulkarni and Simon Price, my name's Al Needham. This is Chart Music. Stay safe, stay indoors, but above all, stay pop-crazed.
Chart Music.
GreatBigOwl.com.
I'm Tilly Steele.
And I'm Helen Monks.
And this is Bitchin'.
I'm dyslexic.
Yeah, why do you read the Wikipedia page?
It's good to practice.
A podcast where every week we talk about a different person.
So how old was he when he first popped on the scene?
That's a great
question. If you say he was my age, I'm gonna fucking die.
And we veer wildly off track.
Pop that Prosec.
Available on all your podcast apps. That's not right. Just
can you not say in the advert?
Available on all your podcast platforms. Just search Bitchin' or Great Big Owl.
We'll see you there.
That was all right.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.